WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Presidential historian Michael Beschloss has been closely following the impeachment process and examining how other presidents have been held accountable for their misdeeds. Beschloss is the author of four books about the American presidency, including The Crisis Years, Kennedy and Khrushchev, and Kennedy and Roosevelt, The Uneasy Alliance. His latest book, Taking Charge, The Johnson White House Tapes, is out in paperback. Michael Beschloss is also a regular commentator for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. I asked Beschloss if he thinks the four articles of impeachment represent impeachable offenses.
One thing that has been a constant through history is that every generation has to interpret what that phrase in the Constitution really means, high crimes and misdemeanors. In a way, the framers let us down because they left it very much open for each Congress that had to grapple with this to try to decide what they really meant. And the good side of that is, here's a case in which the Constitution is infinitely applicable to a society, in this case 200 years later, that they could not have ever imagined. The problem with it is that if you've got offenses that fall into that gray area, as probably we're dealing with right now, the result is that unless a lot more people are persuaded, you could have a situation in which a president is impeached by the House, but still there is a very big number of people in the country who were very angry about that verdict.
I think the thing that the people who support impeachment, whether it's the people in Congress or American citizens, the thing that they find most abhorrent is that the president lied to them. You know, and they say they say that the president lied under oath as well. And I'm wondering if your studies of earlier presidents show that presidents in the past have lied as well, too, whether that was under oath or not.
Well, there isn't much of a case of lying under oath because presidents in history have rarely had to testify under oath. And actually, one of the canards, I think, that's grown up this year is that there has been this great history of all sorts of presidents telling lies, and that for presidents to tell the American people or tell Congress an untruth is sort of more of the same. And there certainly have been cases in which it has seemed almost that way. One case that is raised, for instance, is Dwight Eisenhower after the downing of an American U-2 spy plane in 1960. That was at a time when that plane went down in the Soviet Union. The American government announced a cover story. They said that this was a weather plane that had strayed accidentally into Soviet airspace. That was later disproved. But the point is not that Eisenhower told that lie, but actually that Eisenhower was not allowed to utter that lie. The people around Dwight Eisenhower said it is much too important for the president's word not to be shadowed. Therefore, if we have to hand out a cover story, do it from a lower level. Make sure that no untruth passes the lips of Dwight Eisenhower, because the president's connection to the American people is a vital national resource.
You edited the LBJ tapes, the private tapes that he made during his White House years, and there were a lot of surprises in those tapes. I'm wondering if when you were going through those tapes, you felt, President Johnson lied to the public at some point because what he said on these private tapes doesn't jive with what he told the public or told the Congress.
In Johnson's case, certainly, he, throughout the Vietnam War, conveyed that he was a lot more optimistic about our ability to win the war in Vietnam than he really was privately, and those tapes certainly bear that out. But in Johnson's case, as with Eisenhower's, they were very careful not to have the president utter declarative sentences that could be later on disproved, because Johnson, as a 30-year veteran of Congress, knew that if that happened, his connection with the American people and his connection with Congress would snap, and two of the most vital things that a president can draw on is his ability to persuade the American people to do things that perhaps they might not want to do, like go to war, perhaps pay higher taxes at times. And the same thing is true with Congress. One of the most important things a president does with Congress is to persuade members of the House and Senate to do things that they might not at first want to do as well. And the second that your word is clouded, it's awfully hard for a president to do those things.
I was reading that Republicans are saying, the Republican leadership is saying that they expect Republicans in the House to vote their conscience on impeachment, but they expect Republicans to kind of vote with the party on the issue of censure. And that's the official word. And I'm wondering, if you look historically at Andrew Johnson or at Richard Nixon, how much pressure there was to vote the party line for Democrats and Republicans.
In the case of Andrew Johnson, there was a lot of pressure on the radical Republicans to vote against Johnson in the Senate trial. There was a feeling that Johnson was standing in the way of a harsh policy toward the South. And it was said, for instance, about Senator Edmund Ross, the senator whose vote actually cleared Johnson in 1868, that in casting his vote to acquit Johnson, he was looking into his open grave. And the grave had been opened by people who wanted Johnson out of office for ideological reasons. 1974 was a little bit different. By the first week of August 1974, the smoking gun tapes that demonstrated that Richard Nixon was undeniably guilty of the things that he had been accused of were public. It was very hard for even the most diehard Nixon supporter to stay on his side. And so the result was that when John Rhodes, the House Republican leader, and Hugh Scott, the Senate Republican leader, and Barry Goldwater went to Richard Nixon to talk to him and tell him what his chances were, Goldwater said, "I think you've got a chance of about 10 or 15 votes in the Senate, and I doubt that I'm going to be one of your votes."
Edmund Ross, who you mentioned, was the congressman who was undecided till officially undecided till the last minute. He was approached by both parties to vote their side. Both parties pursued him. He voted against the impeachment, saving the Johnson presidency. Do you know what the Democrats and Republicans did to try to convince him to vote their way?
Oh, it was not a very noble episode. There were all sorts of offers that were made of greater patronage if he voted one way or another, better committee assignments. This was a case in which there was a lot of horse trading involved. And a noble case, because here is one of the big moments in American history in which a leader on whom everything turned decided to side with principle rather than his crass self-interest, and indeed he was defeated for re-election.
What else happened to him?
He wound up one of the profiles in courage in John Kennedy's book published in 1956. Kennedy felt that if Ross had lost his office, at least Kennedy would try to redeem him as an example of someone who was able to take a very big political risk. So in the end, at least a century later, Ross became, at least for a while, a household word.
What message do you think the Edmund Ross story might have to House members today who are about to cast their vote on President Clinton's impeachment?
What the Edmund Ross case suggests is that this is the moment on which many House members years from now will probably be judged by history, and they really should vote their gut instinct.
What do you think are some of the most history-making moments of the Judiciary Committee's impeachment of President Clinton? History-making moments beyond the final vote, but what was said, how people behaved, what they examined, how they examined it?
I think it's not just memory. When you look at the Judiciary Committee over the last few weeks and compare it to the Rodino Judiciary Committee of 1974, somehow the rhetoric seems less soaring and the issues seem of less magnitude. And I think that reflects a few things. One is that members of Congress are simply less heroic, I think, in the current age than they were even 25 years ago. Life has changed. Another is the fact that this does not have the bipartisan flavor that you saw in 1974. And another thing, I think perhaps the most poignant of all, is that in 1974, people in Congress and elsewhere were idealistic enough about government and the presidency, for instance, that when that first vote for an article of impeachment against Richard Nixon was cast, members went into an anteroom after it was all over and actually cried. This was even people who hated Nixon for ideological reasons. They felt that the possibility of an impeachment of a president was of such magnitude and so terrible that this was not something that they had ever expected to do as members of Congress. Nowadays, in 1998, most of us have been through this in our lifetime, and it isn't so strange.
Michael Beschloss is my guest, presidential historian. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the upcoming House vote on impeachment. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. His latest book, just out in paperback, is called Taking Charge, The Johnson White House Tapes. Bob Dole had a piece in the New York Times offering a pretty, I thought, kind of complicated explanation for some kind of censure. Did you read that piece?
Oh, yes.
Maybe you could summarize it and tell us what you think that would mean.
It was Bob Dole's formula, which has added force because this is the man who ran against Bill Clinton in 1996 and would be president now had he won. The idea is not only to censure the president as an alternative to impeachment and a Senate trial, but also to involve him in the process so that it wouldn't be a situation which, let's say, the Senate just passes a censure resolution and the White House sort of dismisses it and it is business as usual. It would very much involve him in signing a document and going up to Capitol Hill. It's got a little bit of an echo of Richard Nixon's experience. Richard Nixon, as we know, resigned in order to avoid impeachment and conviction, and oddly enough, really never confessed or apologized for the things that he was accused of. A month after he resigned and went back to California, he was pardoned by President Gerald Ford and asked to issue a statement in response, and the only statement that Nixon issued was to say that the way I dealt with Watergate was the wrong way is a burden I'll have to bear until the end of my life. That's hardly an apology or a confession of the things that he was accused of. And one of the things that Gerald Ford, I think, is very fairly criticized for nowadays is the following. Ford had the ability to go to Nixon and say, if you want a pardon, if you want to avoid a criminal trial that might put you in prison, I'm going to demand of you that you sign a statement confessing these crimes, saying I was guilty of them, so that years from now you can't go around the United States saying I was driven from office by a political coup for ideological reasons. Ford didn't do that. He didn't have the instinct, I think, to push Nixon to the wall. And the result of that, sure enough, was that Richard Nixon spent the last 20 years of his life saying, I was unfairly driven out of office. These are not things that I should have been impeached or convicted for. And the result is that younger generations who were not aware during Watergate, in many cases, believed him. So I think what Bob Dole is suggesting is involving Bill Clinton in a process like that in a way that will not allow him in the future to say, this is something that was unfair and I was in some way persecuted unfairly.
From your reading of politics, is this a politically workable proposal?
It may prove to be too little too late. The problem with a proposal that is submitted at this point is Bill Clinton right now is at the knife edge of impeachment, and the problem is that this is going to look like some way of evading what seems to be his very likely fate. Had it been submitted a month ago, it might have been very different.
What effect do you think this episode is going to have on the presidency and, you know, the future of people who are living in the White House and serving as our presidents?
We're right now, Terry, at the end of a period in which presidential power has declined in a very big way. I was born in 1955, and the first presidents I remember are John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. They were at the apex of the imperial presidency. They seemed to be almost omnipotent in international affairs. It was a time in which power was flowing to Washington. People were very happy to have government involved in domestic affairs. And also, there was a great mystique about the presidency. For instance, in John Kennedy's case, Kennedy did not wear a hat, and it drove the hat industry into a recession because people saw Kennedy and started to imitate him and didn't wear hats when they were walking down the street. Finally, Kennedy agreed to at least carry a hat to somehow relieve the pain to the hat industry. That shows you how powerful and central presidents were, not only in our American political system, but also around the world. All that has been changing over the last 10 years or so. The Cold War is over. There is certainly no longer a mystique around the presidency, as we've certainly seen the last 11 months. And also, people are beginning to turn away from the idea of a lot of power flowing to Washington. And I think what a future historian might say is what we are seeing this year and perhaps next is another nail in the coffin of the imperial presidency. And what it could lead to is much more assertive Congresses in the future, not impeaching presidents necessarily, but leaders of the House and Senate who in many cases seem to the American people to be more powerful than presidents are. And that's been true through much of our history. Ironically, one of the legacies of Andrew Johnson was that for the next 65 years or so, we saw a series of very weak presidents. Many times, speakers of the House were considered to be much more powerful than presidents were.
Do you think that the impeachment hearings will have the result of presidents, future presidents, holding themselves to a higher standard of truth-telling?
I think that all is going to depend on how Americans view this whole investigation and what is happening on Capitol Hill, and we'll know that in a couple of years. In the case of Andrew Johnson, for instance, rather quickly Americans came to the conclusion that Johnson probably should not have been impeached and certainly should not have been convicted, and that impeachment is not something that should be enacted against presidents, and the result was that for more than a century there was no impeachment. In the case of Richard Nixon was on the brink of impeachment largely for telling blatant lies to the American people. And that did force a higher standard for later presidents. One thing that we haven't seen, for instance, in the last 25 years is presidents who abuse the FBI using those secret files against their political enemies. That's something that we've had a right to expect ever since Richard Nixon. So I think one silver lining to a cloud like this is that when a president seems to be brought to account, it does make his successors think twice.
Michael Beschloss, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Beschloss is a presidential historian. His latest book, Taking Charge, The Johnson White House Tapes, is out in paperback.